Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, renowned NPR talk show host Diane Rehm talks about her new PBS documentary, When My Time Comes. It's about medical aid in dying and the death of her husband of 54 years. Plus, a new storytelling project chronicles experiences around last year's devastating Creek Fire. But first, although only one official Asian American hate crime was documented last year in Fresno, city leaders say many incidents go unreported. As FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, community gardens are one answer to helping people feel safer, but funding is at risk.
Mi Vu stands in the middle of three neat dirt rows, looking down as she points out the watering line running the length of her garden. The drip system feeds her newly planted corn crop and cabbages, all flowering in various stages. She's busy moving her garden hoe, getting rid of weeds that have sprouted since her last visit to the community garden at Fresno Interdenominational Refugee Ministries, or FIRM. Vu lives right across the street and often spends time in the garden.
I started gardening here because my kids said it would be a great way for me to be able to be active as well as have some social interactions so I wouldn't be as lonely while the kids were out or folks were at work.
Vu is one of 16 Hmong and Lao elders who maintain this garden. Every square foot of space is filled with Southeast Asian herbs and vegetables.
This is the green mustard seed. That they're drying it so they can plant them next year.
Tony Buntapanya is the garden director and bookkeeper at FIRM. He manages a total of 5 community gardens like this throughout Fresno and Clovis. In all, he says 70 people work the gardens, but there's not enough space for everyone.
Over 40-something people is on the waiting list. So, because once they get to come and work, They never want to leave, so.
He says the gardens have always helped elders with their mental health, relieving stress and encouraging social interaction with peers. But now they've become even more crucial as safe spaces in a threatening climate. Christine Barker, FIRM's executive director, says people talk to her about their fear of being attacked, especially after the mass shooting in Atlanta that left 6 Asian Americans dead.
I hear from the elders that we serve here about how much they've changed their lives upside down to avoid going outside.
Barker says since the start of the pandemic, elders have told her about racist incidents like slurs and property crimes. But tensions escalated this year.
It's really only been in 2021 that we started hearing stories about physical assault.
Vu lives with her granddaughter Melanie Lee, who also works at FIRM. Lee says she was already worried about the risks of COVID-19, but the recent rise in anti-Asian violence has made her even more protective of her grandma.
Like, I wouldn't let her go out. If she goes out, I'll let her know. I was like, please only go there and come back. Wash your hands, put your mask on, put your gloves on, put your shields on. And so I was very cautious.
It's an issue Fresno city leaders addressed this week when they introduced a resolution denouncing discrimination against Asian American communities. The announcement was made during a news conference Tuesday morning at FIRM. Mayor Jerry Dyer acknowledged the rise in hate crimes.
So we know they occur. They occur right in our own communities. But seldom do they get reported to government officials.
He said the underreporting of crimes is linked to cultural barriers and distrust of government authorities. That's why, as part of the resolution, the city outlined hiring a liaison to the Asian American community first. The mayor wants to create the Office of Community Affairs that will staff liaisons to serve all diverse communities in Fresno.
I'm hopeful that we can, through this Office of Community Affairs, establish that level of trust, that liaison, with folks being out in the community, and partnering with the community-based organizations so that they're more willing to come forward.
The council has 120 days to hire the first position. One of the commitments in the resolution is to provide safe public spaces for Asian community members, especially elders. Firm's executive director, Christine Barker, says the community gardens are a prime example of that.
We deserve to feel safe when we leave our house. We deserve to feel safe in our house. We deserve to feel safe outside of our house. And so that's what we need from the city of Fresno. And this is an example of what that can look like.
But right now, funding for the gardens is in jeopardy. Money for the program through the Department of Behavioral Health runs out at the end of June. Firm is hoping the city of Fresno will approve a community development block grant for $50,000 to keep the program running for another year, starting this July. Still, that's only half of what they usually get, and Firm hopes the new liaison will advocate for more aid. Garden Director Tony Buntapanya says funding is important because the program also provides mental health services.
We have a peer support group, so we can teach them how to deal with the stress and suicide for prevention.
These days, Mivu's granddaughter Melanie will often go with her to the garden. She says working there helps her grandma feel more connected to her Hmong culture.
Gardening is part of their life. That's how they grew up, like overseas. In Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, they all learned, and that's how they feed themselves, they earn themselves. And so, you know, gardening is a very important thing for them.
It's a legacy she hopes the elders can continue to grow and maintain. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Some community members in Fresno are offering patrolling and other services to help street vendors feel more safe. This comes, FM89's Mari Bolaños reports, after a second street vendor in the last year was shot and killed while on the job.
Yo aquí tengo el mismo que trae usted.
Sí, mija.
Usted mira en la esquina derecha que se mira que se levanta para arriba.
Ajá.
That's Valeria Rodriguez Pedrosa, a community organizer leading street vendor protection efforts, on the phone with her aunt, Angelita Rodriguez. She's telling Rodriguez how to use pepper spray to protect herself when she's out. Rodriguez is a street vendor who used to sell clothes and blankets on the sidewalk outside her apartment complex on South Maple Street.
There are times when we sell clothes at the swap meet, but it's been a while since I've done it. I haven't gotten out since they robbed me.
Rodriguez says the man who robbed her pretended to be an interested customer. He asked her which blankets were her most expensive. She says when she turned to grab some of the blankets hanging on the fence behind her, he took off with as many blankets as he could.
I was scared. More than anything, it left me shocked.
Rodriguez says she yelled at the man as he drove off, telling him she had his license plate numbers. But she didn't. And she says she didn't file a police report either.
One, we don't have papers, so we're scared.
And she says now she has another reason to be afraid. 2 weeks ago, an 18-year-old shot and killed street vendor Lorenzo Perez while he was selling corn in southeast Fresno. Rodriguez says she felt paralyzed when she heard the news.
I wanted to cry when I heard they killed that man. We're just out here looking for a better life.
Fresno police say there were 6 incidents involving street vendors last year, but experts say many more go unreported. Community organizer Alex Ramos Ocasey says many street vendors don't go to the police because they're afraid they'll be arrested for being undocumented or cited because they don't have the proper permits.
They're just trying to take care of their families. They're trying to take care of themselves. And especially when we're in the middle of a pandemic and, you know, some folks, right, haven't gotten any government assistance, especially like a lot of our undocumented community.
That's why following the news of Lorenzo Perez's death, Ramos Ocasey and Rodriguez Pedrosa began organizing community members to provide pepper spray and other forms of support to street vendors. At the city level, Councilmember Luis Chavez, who represents the Fresno area where Perez was killed, is forming a street vendor association. He's also calling for increased police presence in the communities where vendors work and a streamlined permitting process so vendors can operate legally. Ramos O'Casey says they want their efforts to be guided by the vendors themselves.
We just want to make sure that, you know, we're asking them, right? You know, like, this is the support that we can offer you in this moment, but we would like to continue, right, and make sure that you feel comfortable telling us, right, if there's additional means of protection that you would like later on.
And Rodriguez Pedroza says that protection might look different for each type of street vendor. The type of assistance they need might vary depending on whether they're pushing a cart of paletas or elotes or if they're selling clothes on the street corner.
When you see someone who is mobile, it's because they're at the very start of their business. So oftentimes they'll start mobile and then they'll have a corner where they have a developed group of customers that know them, that know they're going to be at that spot.
Rodriguez Pedroza says most vendors are usually alone and therefore vulnerable. That's why she's also introducing them to mobile payment services like Cash App. That way, she says, street vendors won't have to carry as much cash with them. It's a hot day on the corner of Tulare and Cedar in southeast Fresno. Rodriguez Pedroza is helping Francisco Rodriguez set up a Cash App account. Francisco and his wife Esperanza say they've sold shoes, purses, and construction gear on this corner since the start of the pandemic.
They closed the swap meet, so our sales dropped, so we had to look for other options.
Esperanza says they've been feeling a lot of anxiety since they heard about what happened to Lorenzo Perez.
We are scared that something can happen to us. We're here with our little business, and this is how we live.
The couple says someone robbed sweaters from them in December, but they continue to work because it's the only way to support their family. Rodriguez Pedroza says she and other organizers will continue to patrol the area so that the couple and other vendors can feel safe while working.
That would just be a means of just showing up, right? Strength in numbers. Just being there, being aware, paying attention to what's going on.
She says they will continue to provide PPE, pepper spray, and video recorders to street vendors that want them. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
This story is part of the Central Valley News Collaborative, which is supported by the Central Valley Community Foundation with technology and training support by Microsoft Corporation. This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Legendary NPR talk show host Diane Rehm is on a mission, inspired by the death of her husband John after 54 years of marriage. In 2014, he was denied medical aid in dying during his final days battling Parkinson's disease. Since then, Rehm has become an advocate of expanding access to medical aid in dying, and she explores the topic in the new PBS film, When My Time Comes. I spoke with Rehm about the project, her husband, and their love story.
John Rehm was the smartest man I've ever met in my life. And he was also full of humor and charm and grace. He and I met while we were both working at the Department of State. I as a secretary, he as a lawyer. We started dating, and it was a wonderful romance. And then we got married, and David Rehm, our son, was born 9 months to the day after we were married. John, after he retired, I kept working, doing my own show, and he'd wait for me to walk when I came home in the afternoons. And I started hearing a shuffle in his walk. So I was nervous when I heard that shuffle. And then he had a few very minor car accidents, and we knew something was wrong. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and He suffered through that for 10 years. At the end, he had been diagnosed as being within 6 months of death. So he could no longer feed himself. He could not stand on his own. He could not shower on his own. He could not toilet himself. So he asked that our daughter, our son, be in the room. And John said to the doctor, "I'm ready to die, and I want you to help me." And we were in the state of Maryland, which at the time and still now does not have medical aid in dying. So the doctor said to him, "The only thing you can do is to stop eating, stop drinking water, and stop taking medication." And at the time, he was furious with the doctor. So after the conversation ended and I left and came back the next day, I was stunned to see he looked radiant. He really looked like the old John. I mean, his face was pink, his eyes were bright, he was smiling, and I said, "Sweetheart, what's happened? You look wonderful." And he said, "I have begun the journey." He had stopped drinking water or eating or taking medication, and it took 10 days for him to die. And it's hard to go through that. It's hard to watch someone you love die over that period of time. And I know many, many people have been through this. And shortly thereafter, I stepped away from the daily microphone. And a filmmaker approached me and said, "We are interested in doing something on medical aid in dying. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Immediately, absolutely."
You know, one of the things that was so interesting to me was how precise you are in your language. You use the term medical aid in dying as opposed to a term that may be more common amongst some of our listeners, physician-assisted suicide. There's a very specific reason for that. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Suicide is a choice that people make at any point during their lives. Medical aid in dying is for those who are specifically within that time frame of 6 months of dying. And of course, people say, "Well, doctors can be wrong. You know, I had a friend who was told 6 months and lived for 6 years." And that does happen. But in most cases, doctors can tell, generally speaking. And that is one of the conditions of the rules surrounding medical aid in dying. It is not suicide. The death certificate says, on my husband's death certificate, he died of complications from Parkinson's. He did not commit suicide. People who commit suicide take their own lives into their own hands because they are miserable or they are totally depressed and cannot abide living any longer. People with medical aid in dying want to live. One of the women in our film, Lori, 37 years old, breast cancer that had spread throughout her body, says, if I had my druthers, I'd live until I'm 90. But I don't have a choice. The one thing I can do is make sure that my 12-year-old does not see me suffering. And so, when my time comes, I will take the medication and I will go peacefully. That's the difference.
So here in California, the End of Life Option Act went into effect in 2016.
Yes.
But one of the issues that your work has illuminated for me is that even in states that have legalized medical aid in dying, the medical decisions a person makes as they approach the end of life could prevent them from accessing this aid. Is that right?
Indeed. If, for example, you are taken to a Roman Catholic hospital, you cannot access medical aid in dying because the Roman Catholic Church is the largest pusher back against medical aid in dying. And what we know is that you have to be very careful about, for example, calling 911, because the people who come in to rescue you will try to resuscitate you, even if you don't want to be resuscitated. And there's a story of an 82-year-old woman who had every document absolutely clearly labeled. She fell and was unconscious, and a neighbor called 911. And she had a heart attack on the way. And she got to the hospital, and of course they resuscitated her. She woke up in the ICU absolutely furious because everything that had happened had gone absolutely against her wishes. So that's why my hope is that this film will get people talking to each other about what they want, not just sons and daughters to their parents, but your doctors, your neighbors, your friends. Everybody needs to talk about death because it's inevitable, and to talk about what you want at the end of your life.
One of the things that I learned from your film is that by having the difficult conversations now, it really leads to a more peaceful time when death does come. It alleviates some of that pain and anxiety.
It can indeed. And, you know, within families, there may be differences of opinion. Within families, you may have brothers and sisters who don't want to let go of mom or dad. No matter what mom or dad has said. So if those conversations do not occur beforehand, there is turmoil at the end rather than a peaceful exit, which is why one of the things I did, not only for the film, but for my family. My grandson was here. He was 19 at the time. And I had him film me on his cell phone while our videographer filmed him filming me, telling everybody what I want at the end of life. And I would suggest to you that it's a great way to inform people of exactly what it is you want.
You have obviously been very outspoken in your advocacy of medical aid in dying, but you're also an award-winning legendary journalist. And I thought the film was really careful to reflect both sides of this issue. And to that end, could you discuss how medical aid in dying intersects with race and ethnicity and concerns over medical malfeasance?
One of the wonderful people I spoke with was a pastor at an AME church here in Washington, D.C., who said, "Diane, if I knew that the medical profession, the government could be trusted to treat those of us of color fairly, I would support medical aid in dying. But think about the history that Black people have experienced. Think about the Tuskegee experiment. Think about what's happened during the COVID. Think about how the people of color have not received the same number of doses of vaccine. Think about how doctors have been treating people of color for decades. Think about how the country has been treating people of color for decades." So with good reason, Pastor Lamar said, "Diane, if you could guarantee me that this would be fair, that everyone would be treated honestly and fairly, I would support medical aid in dying. But right now," said, "I just don't trust." Totally understood.
You know, one more really central, critical question that you explore in the film is this idea of a doctor's oath to do no harm. And the film, I thought, did a really interesting thing in that it framed it as a question of who determines harm. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, that is a central premise of a physician's role toward a patient, to do no harm. And yet, could offering even more radiation, even more chemotherapy, without really knowing if it's going to do any good, and yet making that person feel sicker and sicker, who's determining the harm? It is in the patient's own right to determine what harm we are talking about. And it is in the patient's own right to say, enough. And so I am ready to live out what days I have comfortably with my family. And when my time comes, go peacefully.
Well, Diane Rehm, thank you so much for speaking with us and for informing us and helping us have this critical yet difficult conversation.
Difficult, absolutely. And remember, it's not just one conversation. It's many conversations.
Your film, When My Time Comes, is streaming this month on all PBS platforms and will premiere here in the Central Valley on Valley PBS Wednesday, April 21st at 11 p.m. Diane Rehm, it has been an honor talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the COVID-19 vaccine rolls out and the San Joaquin Valley sheds its pandemic-related restrictions, schools are reopening and students are beginning to return to campus. As part of this week's COVID-19 update, FM89's Carrie Klein brings us the perspective of school healthcare workers preparing to come face-to-face with students for the first time in a year. Carrie, welcome back.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So, as usual, let's first start with a status report from across the valley.
Well, the numbers are continuing to look really good. Average new cases are really low as they were in October when we were optimistic there wouldn't be a second surge. Of course, we all know how that ended. But the number of hospitalized patients is also creeping down slowly, and our weekly number of deaths have been dropping as well. So around 70 deaths were reported in the last week, as opposed to more than 200 just a week ago. Vaccinations are continuing to gain momentum, and in the Valley, we're actually above the state average now for the pace of administering vaccines, which is great news. We are beyond 1.2 million doses in our 7-county area at this point, and 15% of our population is fully vaccinated. Our region continues to open, and now only Merced County remains in the purple most restrictive tier. Tulare and Mariposa counties are in the orange tier, two steps ahead, and the rest of the counties in our area are in red. So everywhere except Merced County, most businesses are allowed some sort of indoor operations, though most still have restrictions, and schools are now allowed to reopen.
But it looks like that whole reopening plan is going to be changing soon, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's looking like it's actually soon going to be scrapped. So Governor Gavin Newsom announced earlier this week that he plans to fully reopen California's economy by June 15th, though that's as long as hospitalization rates remain low and vaccines become available to everyone over 16 who wants one. Now, the state didn't really specify how they'd evaluate those numbers, like if there are certain thresholds that must be met, but there it is. And under that plan, most industries would see their business go back to normal, what they were before the pandemic.
So who is eligible for the vaccine at this point, and where can they get it?
So officially, for right now, all Californians over 50 are eligible. But on April 15th, just next week, that'll change to everyone over 16. And some counties are ahead of the game. Fresno and Kern have already opened up eligibility to everyone over 16. As for where to go, the list of clinics keeps growing. So Kern and Fresno counties, for instance, have huge mass vaccination sites capable of giving out hundreds to thousands of doses per day. You can register for those through the county or at myturn.ca.gov. Private insurers and clinics have vaccines. Commercial pharmacies like CVS and Rite Aid have vaccines. Many counties are sending out mobile clinics into rural areas. Unfortunately, there is still not one, just one centralized place to register for a vaccine yet. So your best bet is to check your county health department's website or get in touch with your doctor or visit the websites of specific pharmacies or all of the above.
As you said, with most counties in our area out of the purple reopening tier, schools are beginning to open their doors back up to students. What is school going to look like for students over the next few months?
Well, there is a ton of variation between school districts. So many are implementing a phased approach, allowing only a few grade levels back on campus at a time. Some are staggering which students are on campus when, or offering hybrid schedules with students in person a few days or virtual a few days. Some are offering on-campus learning, but for shorter days. You know, my daughter is too young to be in school, but boy, do I not envy parents of school-aged kids right now having to navigate all of this.
Yeah, my stepdaughter is a senior in high school, and it's been a year for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, you know, I also don't envy school district employees. The public discourse about schools tends to center on teachers and parents, you know, and rightly so. But Carrie, you sought out the perspective this week of school nurses and social workers. Tell me, what has the last year been like for them?
Yeah, I was really curious about this. I mean, you know, what can you do when so much of your work is centered around taking care of kids in an exam room or meeting with them in your office between classes? And the answer is a lot. So, you know, one person I spoke with is Priscilla Hansen. She's a school nurse at Bullard High School in Fresno. She says a lot of her work actually did carry over virtually. You know, she does a lot to make sure that kids are up to date with their immunizations. She screens kids for special education, things like that. But she also ended up doing a lot more work to track down students when they didn't show up for class this past year. And so sometimes it came down to, you know, a technology problem. Sometimes the student needed a cheerleader.
Part of it is just, you know, letting them know that everybody's trying to do the same thing and that they're not alone. And that happens when they're on campus too. We say, you know, if you're going through this, you're not alone. You know, even things like their technology and making sure that they can get in touch and make sure, you know, if they're going to tell me something like, well, you know, I'm shy, or the parent will say this student's shy and they don't feel comfortable saying things on Zoom, that I can get in touch with the teacher.
And then there is Kim Reynolds. She's a social worker with Kern High School District in Bakersfield. She too got pulled into these so-called non-engagement teams that were out there tracking down students. But her team of social workers also had to pivot to providing more direct resources to students. For instance, many schools created so-called closets with supplies for students in need.
They would have just, you know, general clothing, food, things like that. And that was open to all students that needed it. So that was something that was done differently this year that will probably continue on. We've just seen a huge need as far as basic needs go during this time. And so that's something that we're probably going to continue on even after the pandemic.
So that's interesting. They found a new way to provide some resources to students. I imagine that's not the only positive to come out of this year.
No. In fact, a few administrators told me that there have been some advantages to, you know, this virtual conferencing technology. For instance, another admin with the Kern High School District told me he actually saw a huge uptick in parent engagement online. And so more parents joined conferences with teachers when they didn't actually have to be there in person. And then Rebecca Banky, she's another social worker with Kern High School District. She told me that she feels that she has more tools to be able to meet students where they are. For instance, before the pandemic, if a student didn't show up for a meeting, she'd have to wait until the next week to follow up.
But now I can actually say, hey, since you're at home, do you want to do Zoom? One of the students right now, like, we're actually doing a self-esteem workbook, and putting it onto the screen has been nice because she already had low attendance in the beginning. And so her nervousness of coming back, I can ease that and still work with her over the computer screen.
What are these healthcare workers expecting to see when students come back to campus?
Well, first off, I mean, those I spoke with are excited. I mean, they can't wait to see their students face to face again. But they know that there will be challenges. You know, kids have been struggling. There's been lost learning, lost socializing, you know, the grief and trauma of the pandemic, you know, potential upheaval at home with families. Some kids will be back in their element, but others who may have actually excelled with online learning could have trouble adjusting back to the world of routine and structure and socializing. Rebecca Banky, though, one thing she's excited about is to regain confidentiality in meeting with her students.
And I have been setting up a lawn chair in their front yard and talking to them with their parent coming out, or a neighbor, or their little siblings. So I'm excited just to have a place where we can have some private one-on-ones better than what we have been having.
And then for Priscilla Hansen, the school nurse in Fresno, you know, she's wary of students following guidelines, keeping their masks on and being safe. But one thing she says she can't wait for is just the sound of the students in the hallways.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. In the wake of the damage that last year's Creek Fire brought to the Central Sierra, an effort is underway to keep the fire from claiming yet another casualty, that of memory. The Creek Fire Storytelling Project is a campaign by the Central Sierra Resiliency Fund to document and preserve the stories of the fire and the unique histories that predated it. To learn more, I spoke with the fund's council member, Kristen Tellis. How did this idea come about?
The Central Sierra Resiliency Fund, which is the organization that's running the Creek Fire Storytelling Project, was created in the early days of the Creek Fire. So as the fire was raging, some local community members and professionals joined together to form the Resiliency Fund. And as part of that, they formed within the Central Sierra Historical Society and Museum, to support the revitalization of the forests and communities surrounding Shaver Lake through land restoration, local stewardship, and economic efforts that honor the historical legacy of the Central Sierra region. When I got involved with the council, one of the parts that I was really interested in was in preserving this historical legacy and in creating a forum where people could share their stories so that the fire doesn't delete that special memory of what came before the fire for people. So I want we as a group, this is certainly not my program, this is our program, wanted to collect people's stories of the Creek Fire and also stories of places before and after the Creek Fire. So we're collecting stories of both types. I mean, sometimes the story is before the Creek Fire, during the Creek Fire, and after the Creek Fire. It depends based upon who is submitting.
It seems to me that this project is important not only in preserving the past, but also in helping those who went through this fire to heal and move forward.
I think that is absolutely true. In our program statement, we say that we think that a component of recovery is acknowledging the grief brought on by the disaster, as well as remembering what came before. And in the emails I've received from people after I've responded about the stories they've submitted, I've had people say, I didn't realize until I started reading how other people were feeling the same things that I was feeling. Or it's so helpful for me to have a place where I can really reflect on this. What was this really powerful experience in my life, a really dramatic experience in my life. So I do think that it's about that emotional aspect as well.
Can you share a story with us?
So I'm going to read an excerpt. This is from Victoria Bell, who was at Huntington Lake and had been living there for a few months while she and her husband were on, or her husband was on leave from the military. So they were in a transition period and she was living at Huntington with her two young sons. And this is about her evacuation. She writes, 10 minutes later, sirens, a loudspeaker. It was time to pack. Before the law enforcement even arrived, I was literally running through the cabin, up and down the stairs, packing everything I could. Car seats. Ugh, why didn't I put those in Aunt Elle's truck as soon as she arrived? Nick had been gone for 3 days at that point on a work trip, and the responsible me would have put car seats in the vehicle to allow for immediate evacuation. Evacuation, a word I never thought I would use in my life. We were evacuating the cabin, our solace, our happiness, our everything for the last 2 months. So I ran and I packed. In retrospect, I should have thrown the clothes that were in the dirty laundry basket into a bag. Advice I read several months later, but something I will never forget. As I packed, the police arrived me to tell me what I already knew. We had to leave, evacuate. There was that word again. But my son, my mother, and sister-in-law were still walking. So that's a little excerpt from during the evacuation. And another excerpt from her is a common theme is the feeling of hope at the end, or the feeling of resilience that comes up in many of these stories at the end. And so Victoria Bell also writes, for every tragedy, an aspect of the forest also remains untouched. The fingers of the Creek Fire extended far and wide, but they didn't reach everything. This is the hope we hold on to. We pray that the creeks are unchanged and that as we explore deeper into the Sierra Mountains, we will find more life than death. We have hope. Our hearts are in Huntington now and forever.
Can you speak to how the community is doing?
It's a big range up there. It is not just one community. There are a number of small towns up there with year-round residents as well as vacationers and summer residents. So I think it affects a lot of people very differently. Numerous people who I've spoken with in Pine Ridge, where just a tremendous number of homes were lost, just talk about how hard it is to go back and how hard it is to tell the story, to find the words, and that many people just aren't going back, at least for right now. Our fund has also been doing erosion work and is preparing to begin on tree plantings. And the people we've helped with erosion have, one man literally said that he felt that we were a life raft in a life where he felt like he was drowning, because it's just been so much to handle.
Getting back to the storytelling project, can you talk about the long-term goals for the project? I understand that they involve creating some kind of a physical space.
Yes. So The Resiliency Fund is part of the Central Sierra Historical Society, which has the Museum of the Sierra in Shaver. We hope to have a Creek Fire exhibit at the museum. The board of the museum itself is working on what the details of that are going to be, but we want to have a component of that be, you know, information on the fire itself, but also on how the fire impacted the community. So have a storytelling component of that. We've also talked about having roadside kiosks that help tell the story of the Creek Fire. And I would like to create a book of the stories of the Creek Fire.
But in the meantime, all of these stories as you collect them are available to the public online. Is that right?
Almost all of them are available online. Yes, they're not all up yet, but we are putting them on our website so people can read stories that are coming in at museumofthesierra.org/resiliencyfund/community-stories.
Well, Kristen Tellis, council member with the Central Sierra Resiliency Fund, thank you so much for sharing some of this important project with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The late Ricardo Favela was the child of farm workers in Dinuba, and he went on to become a celebrated artist, teacher, and activist who helped found the Royal Chicano Air Force. Now he is being celebrated by Arts Visalia in the exhibition Seen and Unseen, Ricardo Favela's Expressions of Chicano-Chicana Art, which runs through the end of the month. I spoke with the exhibition's project manager, Lucia Vasquez, about Favela's art and legacy.
You know, we chose the name Seen and Unseen for various reasons. One is Chicanos were everywhere. We are seen everywhere, but many times we are unseen. We are not valued. We are not appreciated for the rich culture that we have. This particular art exhibit has one wall full of these incredible posters that when they first came up over the last 40 years were put on telephone poles and fence posts and were able to announce, you know, dances and events. They were on college campuses. So that would be the seen part. The unseen is actually on a couple of the different walls. Mr. Favela was an archivist and a teacher. So there's a whole wall that shows the in process of the posters, you know, what the steps look like, what the outlines, the design, which is kind of cool. And then we have a whole wall of things that have never been seen that were pulled out of his sketchbooks and out of his private collection. He's got a whole comic strip that's never seen public before. The public has never been. And then there's other things like the etchings that you can actually see the etching plates to some of the etchings that have been done. So it really is a seen and an unseen exhibit. The other thing that I think is really cool is that Mr. Favela went to Dinuba High School and COS before he went to Sacramento State to help co-found the Royal Chicano Air Force. And some of his early works when he was first and foremost a ceramicist are these little figurines of vatos, of his people from Dinuba. They're actual people from Dinuba that were his models, and he modeled these little figurines after.
So I understand that the exhibition has been a springboard for a series of community conversations about the Chicano arts movement and activism and how all of that connects to this sort of current moment of racial reckoning that we're dealing with. Tell us a little bit about those conversations.
Well, the whole exhibit came about because Eddie Salas, that was a good friend of Mr. Favela, really, and a good friend of the family, really wanted to be able to showcase his work at COS since that's where he came from. But like I said, Mr. Favela was an archivist and he was a teacher, and he also had a lot of philosophies about being a Chicano and what that meant. So when COVID happened and we could no longer have the exhibit at COS and have some of the outlying festivities, we wanted a floricanto, we had a whole plan to do that stuff, we really had to kind of switch to virtual. And so what came out of the virtual were these pláticas that you're talking about, this series. The original grant was to engage community in conversation about art. And so we really delivered by doing these pláticas. And we tried to, as best as we could, use the philosophy Murphy and save that legacy of Mr. Favela, who was very ingrained in the community. For 38 years, he taught barrio art. He ran the barrio art, which allowed college students to come into the community of Sacramento and kind of reseed the idea of Mexican traditional art and expose them, and then allow these students, sometimes, and I say students because sometimes it was youth and sometimes it was senior, to be able to connect to the arts again in populations that many times are marginalized, and really doing art was not a priority. You had to go, you know, work and do those other things. So he was able to really give a gift to the Sacramento area by doing this art. Here in the Central Valley, the entire RCAF really supported the UFW and the stuff that was happening in the Chicano movement at that time. And that's why I say that his work really does document, his work and that of the RCAF really documents the Chicano movement in the Central Valley. So these pláticas are kind of our way of supporting what's happening now, but in that theme of really community engagement.
So I understand the exhibition runs through the end of the month. What is coming up for folks to enjoy?
Oh, it's so exciting. As I said, part of what our grant was for and our intention was to engage the community in conversation and to expose the general public and the new generation to different facets of Chicano art. Part of the Chicano art is the exhibit, which we're going to have extended hours on Saturday, April 10th from noon to 9 p.m. You can actually get an appointment and have your pod, have the people that you breathe with on a regular basis, have 30 minutes to enjoy the exhibit all on your own, masked, but in a safe environment. And in addition to that, we are exposing people to Chicano music, and we are going to have 4 hours of a DJ from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. As a drive-by, you can come by and hear some Chicano music. We'll be projecting some of those posters on the wall, images so that you can see that. It will also be live streaming on Facebook. So if you can't get out there physically, certainly you can listen to Facebook and get an idea of Chicano music. Chicano music is very eclectic. So you'll hear stuff is like, that's Chicano music? Because we are from the United States. We are born here. We have all the same influences of the American mainstream music, as well as traditional Mexican music, and maybe some salsa thrown in there. We are a product of the United States of America, Central Valley, Aslan, all of California. So Chicano music is eclectic, and we're really excited to be able to share some of that. And it's going to take at least 4 hours to do that.
And information can be found on the website, artsvisalia.org. Is that right?
Artsvisalia.org will have the phone number, and you can sign up there as well. There is a virtual show. So if you really can't make it out, you know, check out Facebook to hear the music, and check out artsvisalia.org to actually see the show.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to be on the show and for bringing this amazing art to the Central Valley.
Thank you so much.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.